Fortunately or unfortunately, depending upon how you look at it, I have over 40 years of experience in small group and also over 40 years of experience in managed care. So,
Were those at the same time?
I really am good for my age. So how do I do this, though? What's it doing here? Oh, thank you. Okay, so I'm going to take you down, sort of a road nostalgic. I'm not going to go through all these rules in detail here, but just to remind people, the flexibility most of you had for the pre-ACA, and obviously this varied by state, and getting into some of the other rules that maybe aren't as noticeable as these. These are pretty... the popular ones, what I call the sexy ones that everyone comments, you know, you can't use gender, blah, blah, blah. But here are some of the other things that really had a great impact on the ACA. Pre-ACA area, most of us had a lot of flexibility in how to define our areas. Post-ACA, we didn't, and that alone created some disruption. Group size, most states allowed some sort of group size function. Or factor, I should say. Dependent tiers. I would say in the small group market, a four-tier was pretty common. Not always. Some states, per-member rating was more popular, but generally four-tier. Post-ACA, you had to go essentially a per-member rating. All of these things really caused a lot of disruption in the small group market. And just, the composite rating methodology required for the ACA business. Oh, boy, if you really ever want to have a miserable experience, try and figure that one out, and try and explain that to a group. Here we go. Benefits. We've all heard about, the EHBs. We had much more flexibility in benefits. We didn't have to worry about the stupid, metal levels and the plus or minus two, which is now what? Something different. Minus four. Yeah, I might have plus two, minus four, which doesn't even help for the bronze because you can't get that low. So all these reforms. So what's happened? Well, 2015, this is from Oliver Wyman, it's on their blog site. As of 2015, it was the first year that the enrollment in the small group market was surpassed by the enrollment in the individual market. Now, the statistics shown here are for a small group fully insured. EBRI had a study that came out that estimates anywhere from 8 to 13% of the small groups defined as under 50 for the EBRI report are self-funded. But we see that the small group market, the small group fully insured market has been decreasing. Part of this decrease, and in all fairness, was just due to the economic times too. But if you, how many people here, small group constitutes a significant portion of their fully insured business? Okay, so I was gonna say for most of the HMOs that I work with, small group is an important segment. And if this segment's gonna be changing this and whatever comes down the pike for proposed reforms. This is another report from Oliver Wyman. And what it shows is that the decrease in small group membership, the decrease ranged from minus 20% to minus 1%. Only two states outside that had positive enrollment, and one of that was DC, but that's because they classified the congressional aides as small group. And they had to, buy into the exchange. And then Montana. Is there anyone here from Montana? Because I don't know why Montana beat the K. So, but the states that allowed the transitional policies actually experienced less drop in enrollment than those that did not allow the transitional policies. So it sort of debunks the idea that, ACO was so great. So now we have the wonderful shop. And here's what I call, what happens when a tree falls in the forest and no one's around, or someone throws a party and no one came, we call it a shop. You know. You know, there's a solution also looking for a problem. And I think that there's some administrative rules coming down right now that essentially is going to say if you're on the shop, the federally facilitated shop, that essentially there isn't going to be a federally facilitated shop. You really, I guess you go on there to see if you're eligible for shop, but then you're going to have to go to the individual carriers. And they're saying, there's some comment period about, you know, should we do this, should we not? And I said, who cares? You know, just you know, let it die. You know, this is, don't spend any more resources on this. And why did it go wrong? Well, one thing was the transitional plans. There's no ifs and buts about that. The other was the failure to appreciate the role of the agents. And this is, when you talk about your brokers for a large group, trust me, they're even more critical and have more control over small groups, because small groups use the agents as their HR department, because they don't have an HR department. You know, they really, you know, delegated that function to their agent because they're busy building widgets or whatever else they do. They don't have time to mess around in the spreadsheet and all that. The federal government failed to appreciate that. In fact, they fully expected that rates would go down, you know, well, they said 8 to 15% for commissions, and I don't know where they're getting their commission data, but, you know, because you will be able to eliminate the role of the agent, and that was a critical, critical mistake. And, of course, the ease, you know, it was so easy to enroll in the shop to begin with, so. Okay, what did I do here?
So don't hit that.
Okay, that's right, I hit the wrong one. So. Okay, thanks, thank you. I'm also challenged in some things. So, what's next? Well, unfortunately, all the attention at the federal level is on the individual, even the AHCA. And they'll come up with this, like, this continuity of coverage and the 30% load, which we can argue whether or not that's going to be effective in the individual market. And then as an afterthought, they said, yeah, we'll apply that to small group, too. And we've had some questions asked us. I'm also chairperson of the American Academy of Actuaries Individual and Small Group Committee, so I've had the opportunity or whatever of interacting and commenting, you know, a lot on the proposed, and I've had, I have worked with CSIL and continue with CSIL and get there. Sometimes they ask us ahead of time, sometimes they don't. But unfortunately, some of the things that they're talking about with individual, you know, they just don't translate well over to small group. So, I'm not going to go through this in detail, but going back to where we were before, you know, the future, going back to the future type thing, the NEAC model was essentially, the small group rate reform model, was essentially plus or minus 25% variation for morbidity at the group level, and then another plus or minus 10% for different classes of business, and we called it HIAA model. Shows you how old I am, because I actually know what HIAA is. It is now a hip for those of you who weren't, you youngsters here. And they just got rid of the class of business, and they did plus or minus 35. And then they had all these other things that we could rate for. The only reason I put that up is because in the initial AHCA, it got taken out, but in the initial AHCA, they allowed the resurgence of sales of the transitional policies, which would have been able to use the rating rules that had been in effect prior to ACA in the small group market. So that did not get into the one that got signed, or I shouldn't say signed, got passed through the House, but it was in the initial one. So I do think that there is going to be, sooner or later, some more rating flexibility, maybe. The sunset of EHBs, I think there is a lot of congressional support for more flexibility in the small group market, again, because everyone's focusing on the individual market. And obviously then the transitional plans and are called grandmother plans were allowed through 2018. They were supposed to sunset at the end of 2017. The next slides are really important to anyone in the small group fully insured market. Selling across state lines. If they don't do anything about changing the rating rules, this will have minimal impact. Because there's not that much difference in the EHBs from one state to another. It just isn't enough. And if everyone has to follow the same rating rules, it really doesn't matter. Unless you're in New York or Vermont, then you could have some. New York and Vermont have pure community rating, and so they might be at risk. If they change the rating rules and allow each state to develop their own or go back to what they were, this could have a really big impact. Pre-ACA, there were two states that had no rating rules for non-blue plans. One was Virginia and one was Pennsylvania. Virginia did adopt the ACA rating rules, but I don't know if they would go back and not. I mean, they had no rules whatsoever. So you'd see a lot of companies doing the Delaware thing that we talked about yesterday, somehow incorporating or doing something in Virginia and then selling nationwide. And you can underwrite. You can have unlimited age, gender, yada, 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 yada. This then would hurt single state entities, of which I think most of you are. Here's another one, MIWAs. This has already started. There's a couple of MIWAs I know in Ohio. One of them's going into West Virginia. And I know there's another one that's in Louisiana, just getting started in Louisiana. These are self-funded MIWAs. Talking about self-funded here. And they can underwrite. So it has the same, it potentially can have the same impact as a cross-state selling if they really start taking ground because you're going to be at a competitive disadvantage if you're going to stay in the fully insured market. Association groups, which are self-funded association groups, are going to be in the same category as MIWAs. Is there anyone here from Tennessee? I know there's one person from Tennessee. Anyone else from Tennessee? Have you heard of the Farm Bureau? Oh, yeah. Okay. This is not a theoretical exercise anymore. This has happened in Tennessee, where the Farm Bureau, through some sort of regulatory loophole, I guess that's all I can call it, was never classified as a MIWA or as an insurance company. So they don't have to follow the ACA. And they are medically underwriting in the individual market. And surprise, surprise, Tennessee had the highest risk scores of any state in the union. And now they don't have, at one time they weren't going to have anyone in the market in 2018 after Humana pulled out in the individual market. I heard that maybe Blue Cross of Blue Shield Tennessee might come in. I have no idea why they would. Yeah. Pardon? They would, and I have absolutely no idea why. It doesn't make any business sense to me whatsoever. Because you're comparing a guarantee issue against a fully medically underwritten plan, and I don't think it takes an actuary to figure out who's going to lose on that one.
But. So, I mean, in the counties where there wasn't any coverage on the individual side, I believe it was around Knoxville, Blue yep. Cross Blue Shield decided that they were going to enter, but basically just said, look, we'll charge a very high rate in order to get around that. I mean, in the ACA markets, and I kind of keep making this point over and over again because partially we're in the exchange markets, so I have a vested interest in this. But as long as you are able to increase prices as much as you want, there's not really a way to lose because your customers don't see those price increases.
Well, they do off exchange.
Yeah, but who cares about off exchange? It's 50, so small.
Well,
50, I mean,
no. Well, nationwide, maybe small in Knoxville, but nationwide, it's like 42% is off exchange.
Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, I, I think on the individual side, there will always be someone who's going to come in on the exchange side, as long as regulators let you raise prices as much as you want.
The only thing I'll say is, from an actuarial perspective, I'm always, when you say you can't lose, trust me, you can. Because you're chasing the
maybe in
tail.
Iowa, right? $26 million member in Iowa is kicking everyone out of the exchanges because nobody wants that $26 million member. So I,
yep.
Yeah, sure.
Well, I live in Knoxville. So. Blue Cross on the exchange lost $200 million. They hadn't been paid yet, a lot of it, because of risk corridor. I am sure that they're not really interested in being back on the exchange in Knoxville. However, there's a very close relationship between Blue Cross and the governor. And Blue Cross for 50 years has been given a lot of leeway, just like Farm Bureau, to do things. And then whenever the governor, for perception reasons, needs them to go back on the exchange, for instance, in Knoxville, that's probably why.
And I don't want to get bogged down on the individual side, but all I'm using, it is an example of what happens when you have two different systems that are not playing by the same rules. And it doesn't bode well for the fully insured entity. And you're going to have exactly the same thing happen if self-funded association groups and or self-funded MIWAs are going to start proliferating in the small group environment and they're going to be allowed to use, the even more variation in rates. There aren't going to be any limits whatsoever in the variation of rates, even among, it'd be even wider than what you see in the transitional plans. So what's next? Self-funded is, or self-insurance is going, could be, I have to qualify this, could be a real need in this space. And obviously, I call it growing among smaller small firms. However, Assurant was going down to 5 lives, and I know Trustmark goes down to 10 lives. So it depends upon what your portfolio is. You know, if your average life size group is 7, this may not be a viable alternative for you. But, you know, if your average group size is, 15 or 18 or 20 or whatever it might be. And the PACE Act, remember when the small group was supposed to go up to 100 in 2017? Well, that's one time when the policymakers actually did listen to us, because we told them if they did do that, they were going to destroy the small group market, because especially in the 51 to 99 group, self-funding was going to be a valid option. And the only ones that were going to come in were the ones whose rates were going to be lower by going into the pool, and the one who, and you can design these plans right now, that the maximum rate may be just a little above or maybe even below the maximum that you're going to see in the shop. Here are the states that expanded the definition to 100. No surprise there, you know. They were pretty blue states. Who are they? Now, the self-funding is not going to be an option for all small groups, you know. But they are for the younger, healthier male groups. Another point which I had someone point out to me is that employers that want to implement and benefit from long-term gains of implementing wellness programs, which they don't see that they can do in the fully insured market. Don't know if that's right or wrong, but I'm just saying that is at least a perception that here's another advantage. If I'm going to spend some of this on wellness, I want to get the benefits from it. If I'm pooled among, all the other groups in the, especially if you're in the shop, ACA small group, you're not going to really get the benefit from that, because you can't. You have rating limitations, what we can use. But the continuation of the transitional policies has really lessened the pressure to go self-funded. And that's why how many of you have level premium products right now? Okay. I think that the pressure for those is lessened if you are in a state that allowed transitional policies. I was very interested in the presentation yesterday because there's lots of legislation going on right now in some of these states to really make it more difficult for the smaller groups to go self-funded, especially these really micro, what I call more micro groups. I mean, New York has banned it outright, so I don't know how, you know, the Self-Insurance Protection Act is going to affect that. My understanding yesterday was that all of these rules would be gone. I'm telling you, I'm not sure if that's how some of the states perceive it. But if that is the case, then that bodes well for level funded. If it's not the case, you could have some of your states really trying to stop it. And the reason they are trying to stop it is to protect that small employer pool. And California made no bones about it when they passed theirs. The whole intent was, you know, no, we pushed it up to 100 and you have to participate or whatever, you know. There are really unique challenges to this marketplace. You talk about an unsophisticated buyer. This is the definition of the unsophisticated buyer. They don't know anything about self-funded, and they really don't want to know anything about self-funded. You know, they need to have some insurance that for their cash flow needs, and that's why the level premium is a really probably about the only viable option for this market segment. They need to have some, you know, some monthly aggregation and things like that. But this is not for every group, and it's not for every stop-loss carrier either. There's a lot of bookkeeping that goes on with this. Things that, again, small groups never, they don't have to deal with now. You know, they get their plan documents from the insurance, from you folks. You know, they get their ID. They don't have to submit Form 5500s, and they don't have to worry about all these other reporting requirements that you have to do if you are self-funded. It doesn't matter if you are 5,000 or if you are 25. There's certain things that you have to do. The employer needs to understand the risk, and boy, you better have some document signed that he or she understand that they are self-funded. Do not sell this as it's just like insurance, because it'll bring us all down for one thing, but it's just a lawsuit waiting to happen. Has anyone, well, I shouldn't say heard, I have, this Qualified Small Employer Health Reimbursement Act that was passed in December of 2016 as part of the CURES Act, and essentially allows employers to set up HRAs that employees can use to pay their fully insured premium on the individual market. I bring this up because some people thought that this would be a further erosion of the small group market. Has anyone seen anything? I haven't either. I think one of the reasons is because the individual market right now is so fragile and is dysfunctional. Do they see?
I had heard about it because I had a vendor that had called that said that for employers who weren't offering coverage, they could offer an HRA or an HSA and fund it, and then that would in turn push out so they could use that money for premiums or use of it or whatever. So, you know, I was aware that they had that out there. I didn't know how widespread it was being used, though.
Well, you know, when the ACA was first passed, a lot of us did a lot of studies, and I was one of them, that these studies that predicted that the small group market was going to erode much more than it has. I mean, because they're not subject to the employer mandate, although no one looks like they're going to be subject to the employer mandate. Why it hasn't eroded as much, I think, twofold. One is the dysfunction of the individual market and the exchange market. And the other reason is the transitional policies, which allowed the lower cost groups, you know, if you like your plan, you can keep it, especially if it's cheap. you know, and so they were able, they did not get hit with these big increases. And some of these small groups, if they go off transitional policies, if you are in a, what I would call a flexible rating state, and there's a lot of them out there, their rates are going to go double, more than double, because of all the rating factors that you can use under the transition plans that you can't. So there was, like I said, there was some concern that this would further erode. It was designed for the ones that had already dropped insurance or didn't have insurance to begin with. All I can say is the silence is deafening.
Yeah, basically, that's a defined contribution plan, right?
It is. Well, it's defined contribution without any insurance
right.
at all.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. I think maybe a broader question for this audience is anyone running into defined contribution in any significant way where even the mid-sized market is moving to defined contribution?
No. Really? I'm so surprised.
Wasn't that to your slide where it was a solution looking for a problem? Because for the first time, the federal government reconciled choices across multiple carriers, which has been something brokers and employers alike in the small market have long sought after, but now when they're able to do it, no one bought it. So it's somewhat like the transparency model we were talking about earlier.
And you know, and you bring up a very, very good point that, and this varies a lot by state, but one of the things or the supposedly the advantages of the shop was because you're going to, you know, an individual is going to be able to choose, each of your employees could choose differently, blah, 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 blah. Well, first they found out that was really, really hard to administer. Secondly, it's even harder to come up with a composite rate. We won't even get into that. But thirdly, in a lot of the country already allowed choice within a single insurer. It was very, I'm in Wisconsin. It was very common in Wisconsin. You know, the HMOs. That's what the HMOs had done to essentially distinguish themselves from maybe some of the fully insured. And it also was American Medical Security, AMS, which is now part of United Health, also started that. And if you had, you know, five employees, they could choose five different plans. But all your employees had to buy from AMS. And then, some of the health plans sort of replicated that. Some had more limitations than others. So it wasn't, I mean, that problem that they were trying to solve didn't exist in a lot of places. How many here in your small group portfolio allow an employer to have more than one option? Yeah, see? Again, it was, now you can't go to a different carrier, but... So again, it was a solution looking for a problem. So but what we've also danced around, and I'm going to go through this just to point out, whatever you see for the market as a whole really gets magnified in these small groups because they don't have the members to spread it across from. But all the stuff for ACA and all the reforms, these didn't address the real problem. The real problem is healthcare costs. All ACA did is address insurance reforms, not healthcare costs. You know, so the real challenge here is how to reduce healthcare costs. The people in this room theoretically have the greatest opportunity to reduce healthcare costs because many of you are provider owned. And theoretically, you know, you are in charge over the whole distribution chain. My experience, and I do a lot of work with provider-owned HMOs, is that's not necessarily the case, you know? And sometimes when you don't even align the incentives, or the system doesn't align the incentives appropriately, I'll have the health plan maybe make some sort of risk contract with the owner or the clinic or whatever, and then they're still paying their providers on an RVU basis, and they wonder why their utilization hasn't gone down. You know, you can't have that inconsistency. What's done up here somehow has to get filtered down at the individual physician level if you're going to affect change. That's all there is to it. And there's lots of challenges in doing provider risk contracts, and I'm not going to go through all these. But if you ever really want to have a miserable experience, you talk about patient attribution after the fact. Whoa, you don't get that if you're in a risk contract. Anyone been involved in ACOs? Well, they're a delightful experience, too. But, you know, how to handle large claims and, you know, price transparency, real issue that I've seen with provider-owned HMOs. Reference pricing, balanced bill problem, you know, these are all issues that any entity is going to have. These provider risk contracts just aren't as easy as they first appear to be. But the real problem that we've seen in the individual and small group market in recent years, and again, they get magnified because they just don't have the population to spread them across. Maybe you're seeing this in your large group as well. Are these monster claims? Yeah. When ACA eliminated the lifetime maximum, I was talking to Brian last night and saying, I argued with the reinsurers who told us at the time, because we were trying to talk to the administration, that this was really going to have a huge upward impact on rates. It was only going to be 0.5%. I had never seen a $5 million claim in a single year because most of my clients had lifetime maximums that were that were lower than that. So obviously we didn't see those kind of claims. Now we're seeing like $12 million claims, and these are recurring claims. This $5 million that I was talking about is a recurring claim. The $12 million, I think it was... I know the Iowa one, at least I had read it was $12 million, whether it's $26 million, whatever it was. It's a recurring claim. It's not like an accident or something that it's done. And I did see or hear anecdotally about a $26 million claim, you know, in a single year. Not a lifetime. This is a single year, you know. Some of the charges, like for air ambulance, are any of you seeing some of these things? Like $85,000, $110,000? You know, for short rides, essentially. Have any of you heard about the Alaska high-risk pool that they're doing some sort of reinsurance to try and get their rates down? But the two highest paid providers in the Alaska individual market were dialysis providers. And this is the under 65 market. Specialty drugs. I just am quoting one, you know, right now, that the one for spinal muscular atrophy cost $750,000 the first year and $375,000 years two and beyond, and this does not cover the cost of administering, which requires sedation and recommended to be administered in a hospital. I just use that as an example because when I was doing the slides, this one just came across my desk. But there's others that we can all of us just talk about, this one and that one and this one. These are very high cost. The markups on pharmaceutical products and devices, the variation in same provider depending upon network status. I'm sure some of you are getting hit with like out of network, you know, where AHIP did a study, the 97 procedures, and out-of-network providers range from 118% for an eye exam to 1,382% of Medicare fees. That's what you call a markup. I saw a slide, and I don't have it right now, that says in Texas, people in here in Texas can tell me if this is right or not, but the average charge is something like 900% of Medicare. I've also seen some 90% discounts too, but you know, some states are trying to pass legislation or are considering legislation on limiting the out-of-network charges to a fixed percentage. So like I said, these are issues that transcend all, but once you get into these small groups, they just get magnified. I'm not even sure how large a group you have to be before you can absorb, you know, a $5 million or $20 million claim, but we all know a group of 20 can't. So the future, what will replace ACA, sorry about that, I may have said ACA. Who knows? I would have said something a little differently maybe 2 weeks ago. However, I do believe that we are going to get to a crisis, and this crisis is going to be hitting around August, September. That's when the rates have to be submitted by July 17th for the individual market. And I think there are going to be some areas in the country that may not have any provider on or off the exchange. That may be the catalyst that will get Congress to act very, very quickly. My concern is they'll do something on the individual side and then just sort of toss it over. Same thing for small group, you know, which could be very, very problematic. You know, hopefully there is going to be more flexibility in the rating and the underwriting and the benefits and the cost sharing. Hopefully, I'm not a supporter from a risk perspective on cross-state selling and all that, but if it goes through, I certainly know how to do it because I've done it before. You know, I mean, you have to take advantage of the circumstances that you're in. And if that does go through, you really have to act, and you have to get some sort of self-funded product or something to combat that. Otherwise, you're going to have your clocks rung. And that's the actual world technical term. And you know, in this market, there is no advantage, especially in that ACA market. You know, but you could even see erosion in the transitional market as well, because again, if you're going self-funded, you have no rules. You know, so you can be those small groups, and we even know anyone who's in the small group market knows that you don't have a bell-shaped curve. You have many more groups down at this low end than you do at the high end. We all know that those that are at that lowest end could really be lower. You're limited here simply because of the rules. Well, if you don't have those rules anymore, you know, you can even go lower. Ironically, underwriting is even more important in the self-funded market, in the small group self-funded market, than it is even in the transition. You really need to have good underwriting. And please, don't believe your own press. If you don't have good underwriting, you know, start farming it out or getting some help in or something, because you will have, like I said, you will get your clocks rung on this if you don't have that good skill set. Medical costs, I think that there's going to be more provider risk type contracts. I think it's going to be sort of a painful process getting them in. I don't think the providers really want them particularly. And if I were them, maybe I wouldn't either. Price and quality transparency is a really, really hot topic. I am sort of a pessimist on this one. You know, everyone talks about price transparency. I'm like, you know, you only see 7%, 10% of the people using it. Because of the out-of-pocket maximums, there are some limitations as to really the viability. I do know if you can get people engaged, they will drive cross town to save $20 if they have to pay the $20. But once they hit that out-of-pocket maximum, it's more problematic. And there are situations, too. If you just got a diagnosis of cancer or something, sometimes the least concerns are the price transparency. You have other issues, and like you said, you're going to hit that maximum out-of-pocket anyway. Government intervention, I think there could be some on the drugs and things, but be careful what you wish for on that. I do think we do need to have some, because some of these markups and things are just obscene and the costs are just so high. But there's opportunity. Small employers want to offer health care coverage or health insurance to their employees, especially now as the economy is getting better. A lot of them view it as a means of getting good employees and retaining good employees. Now, there's obviously maybe the entry level or the employers that focus more on entry level employees, maybe they not as much. But generally, they really, really do want to offer it. And so maybe the reforms will be more flexible. If they're not more flexible, though, and these other things, the MIWAs and self-funded association health plans come about, you really do need to take a defensive, if nothing else, a defensive position. Otherwise, the current small group block is going to be eroded. So do I have any questions?
Well, first, I'd like to say, I mean, unsurprisingly, I agree with a lot of the stuff that you bring up here. I'm also very cynical on a lot of these pieces. And I'd be interested to know with the people in this room, maybe not show of hands right now, but maybe just, you know, come up to me later, how many of you feel like your health plan is really a partner with your health system owners, and how many of you feel like you're just an entity owned by a health system? Because I've worked at two health plans that were provider-owned, and in both cases, we had zero say when it came to anything contractual with our owners, and not even just humoring us, like not even just, hey, what do you guys think, and then ignoring it, but just, here's what we're doing. Even if it's terrible, you're doing it. So I think I think really a change in, you made that earlier comment that we had the most, potentially the, you know, the best chance to change. I'm very cynical on that. Maybe I'm not. Maybe I'm the only one. Maybe I'm not. But I really think changing provider reimbursement structure almost has to be a federal act, because I just don't see grassroots methods creating. Such a drastic change, which is what really needs to take place to rein in those trends. And then I also wanted to talk about that pharmacy comment. We've observed that in a very, maybe even extreme way, in a few of our markets. We spent more in 2016 on outpatient pharmacy than we did on ER. And in one market, nobody's going to call my boss after this, right? In one market where we may or may not have had an owner, we spent more on outpatient pharmacy than we did on ER and outpatient surgery combined.
Whoa. That's an eye-opener.
It is, and that was our largest market, so that's not a weird outlier. And all of those trends are tied right back to pharmacy carve-outs. The trends on pharmacy have on the bill charges side, have kept going up. More and more are hitting entry-level points to where they're carved out and paying at a percent of bill charges. And it's very predictable. We model the contract change. We see it in the claims. And now it's becoming to the point where it's, you know, the single largest category that we have based on, you know, our bucketing system. If anyone's familiar with the Milliman system, it's basically that. But, yeah, so I guess just some curiosities there and some comments. But yes, I'm very cynical about the changes that need to take place, and nobody in the Congress has brought up anything even closely resembling something that would control cost, aside from, you know, potentially pharmacy, like you mentioned, and that would be more on the retail side. But
I know I do some rate reviews as well as part of my work. And I won't tell you what state it was in because it doesn't really matter, but it was exactly the same situation as the Iowa had actually disclosed. It wasn't quite that high. And that one entity wanted to pull out of a certain region because of that. And it happened to be a hemophilia claim that was going to occur, you know, so there was no question. Maybe if you could control it, you could maybe get down from $5 million to $4 million. You know, maybe, you know, and the risk adjusters aren't going to do that. You know, they don't go. The Department of Insurance did not allow it. So when they had to come back in, the rates raised. That actually was in the individual market, so they just went off exchange. But, you know, these things have real, real implications. Let me ask something. The ones that have the level funding, how many of you has the enrollment met your expectations? Okay. You have, okay. What do you attribute that to?
Our level funded, we only go down to 35.
Okay.
And primarily, it's 50 to 99, maybe 50 to 125.
Okay.
And so it's market segment specific.
Okay.
And typically from a competitor HMO with limited data. So we're able to sell ours without individual questionnaires.
What are the rating rules in the transitional market that you're in? Do you know in small group market? Are they like plus or minus 25? What state are you in?
Michigan.
Michigan.
Yeah.
They had pretty rigid rating rules on the individual small group market, actually.
Yep.
So I think people in Michigan, it would be a good opportunity to maybe look at the level premium. You know, yep.
It works well for us. Yeah, it's about 50% of our group sales in terms of group count. Mm-hmm. The membership isn't there compared to traditional self-funding, but the group count's about 50%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you do things like, do you prepare the form 5500s and all that for them?
We do.
I was going to say, you have to have a lot more hand-holding, I think, with the small groups, because these are totally, they don't want to be self-funded. The only reason they're going self-funded is because of ACA or very, very rigid rating rules in the transitional market.
You had brought up about provider-sponsored health plans, and we've worked with them for over 20 years. And I think with the change that's taken place with ACA is that your plan then became something you looked at as a learning lab on how do you take on risk and what do you do with it. There's still, most of the systems aren't far enough along that they're taking on so much risk that they've kind of changed their practices. They've got to get to where it's 50% or more. So they're experimenting with it. But once you push them past a certain point, they start doing things differently. MACRA is the other thing that's going to be a key driver, because that's not going away. And so when you get to where the alternative payment models, I think for the plans in this room, you have to look at what are you doing over the next 2 years, that if your system is now looking at the MIPS and that calculation, and they can't count your MA or your Medicaid or anything until later, but what are you doing to prepare when that starts to switch as far as what your networks are doing and where you have in place? The system is still the driver. It's not the health plan for it, but they get to a certain point where they start doing things differently because they have to. The other thing that's driving a lot of this is if you're in Medicare Advantage or you're in some state that has risk adjustment, you've got to get the delivery system on board to be successful in it. And we're spending more and more of our time looking at what are those intersection points where the system and the health plan really have to work in tandem. So there are examples of it, but they're kind of few and far between right now. But you can't go from doing nothing to all of a sudden then being a value-based care delivery system without. And so your role is you can help them get there in a small way and learn from that. But I would say until the last probably 5-6 years, we haven't seen these plans really be the big drivers. The Presbyterian's done a lot of changes in this regard. And what is 70% of your market? Maybe you can
explain it. Yeah, well, first of all, Eric, you realize this is being recorded. I just wanted to say, but with that, our partner, our delivery system, what's that?
Well, he wasn't exposed until you said his name.
You're right. I'm sorry. Yeah, this is Neil Spiro, and our delivery system is a wonderful partner. Yeah, we get along well. What the heck was the question, Kathy? No, you know, in our market, 2/3 of the revenue coming into the system is capitated. So we're kind of like over that breaking point that we have to start doing something, but we're still a little schizophrenic on what you were saying, in that the medical group is capitated, so that they're getting the capitation, but the physicians are still paid on a fee-for-service basis. But we are working together now. So I think we are trying to find ways to lower cost. But, you know, that fee schedule is still a sacred cow, and it's hard to change that, like you were saying. But I think there are other ways around that and trying to control the utilization, doing things. And so I think we're making headway. I think we are.
I have some clients that are both provider-owned clients. Those that were in the Medicare space and those that were not. Obviously, the ones that were in the Medicare space and elected to participate, neither the individual or small group, and most of my clients, the small group is a very big segment of their total portfolio, and they didn't want to walk away from it. I couldn't even get the ones that were in that Medicare Advantage were very, very good at coding, and even they lost out in the risk adjuster process because of the geographic component of it, and that's how it was set up, by the way. And the ones that did not, were not in the Medicare Advantage sphere, really lost out, and you could not get them to believe, you couldn't get the docs to believe, or, you know, that coding was that important because they never had to do it before. And so all of a sudden, you're, you know, pulling in this thing, you say, you have this really, you know, from a risk adjuster's perspective, you have a really, really healthy pool here. And they're like, oh, no, this is terrible. We had this, we had that, we had this, we had that. Well, you didn't code it. You know, I don't know why you didn't. Well, what do you mean? You know, and so some of them have learned a painful lesson in it. And they're still, you know, struggling and catching up. And risk adjustment is not going to go away. It may go away for, you know, the individual and small group market. I don't know. But as you get into some of these other contracts, risk adjustment is any kind of risk contract. That is a very valid and real component on those contracts. So you need to get good at that skill set.
Just a quick question on your capitation arrangements. Are those as a percentage of premium for Presbyterian, or you know, if you're 2/3 capitated within your market, I mean, what's the structure? Because if the medical plan is getting, you know, a piece of this, but you're still paying out fee for service, how does that work?
Well, for Medicare, you know, we see it's fixed amount. For Medicaid, we're in a risk based, it's fixed amount.
Okay.
And about 45% of our state is Medicaid. And we have 45,000 Medicare members, so a lot of that premium coming in is all just budgeted. As far as on our commercial business, we pay on a per-member capitation to the delivery system. Okay. So it's capitated at the member level, and it's adjusted. And then one problem I have, it's adjusted each year to the utilization, which means, you know, are you really getting capitated?
Thanks.
Yeah, I just wanted to make one really quick point about your risk adjustment comment. That provider outreach is a lot more than just we need you to put as many codes as you can on it. Because that's what everybody thinks. So they think about this, you know, like United in the news saying, you know, hey, didn't this person also have this, you know, 20 other diagnoses we want you to put on the chart? But there's a lot more fundamental things than that. Like, you know, doctors need to know what day it is. I mean, that's one of the biggest things is that the member did have it. It is on the chart. It's legitimate. But the chart has the wrong date and it doesn't match the claim, and the system won't accept it.
Yeah,
you know. So and then allowing access to the records, you know, letting people come in and look at the records, just the process of it and all of that are just as big of pieces as, you know, coding specificity can be.
But getting back to, like, if you're capitated, that causes problems on if you want to go self-funded. You know, I'm not saying you can't get around it entirely, but it does just cause more. It's more, much more problematic. Any other questions? And also, I should say one of the key components, if you're going to go self-funded in the small group market, is I'd strongly recommend that you link up with a stop-loss carrier that has a lot of experience in the self-funded market, because you're going to. It's just a different animal than what you. Been used to, and you need to have that expertise. Not that I'm, you know, campaigning for anyone or advertising for anyone, but this is just it's a different skill set. It's a different market, different skill set. From the other perspective, historically, the small group market has been the fastest growing as far as new employers. It has not been for, I think, the last 4 years, 3 or 4 years. But I, you know, hopefully that will turn around sometime, because all big companies start as small companies, you know. So there's lots of opportunities here, and I think there's a great need here, whether you can go the fully insured or the self-funded approach. But theoretically, this should be a great opportunity for growth.
Karen, thank you for letting us tap into your expertise.